Welcome to episode 3 of Vaccines Revealed. I'm your host, Dr. Patrick Gentempo, and today is a spectacular day. In the first interview, I sit down with Robert Kennedy Jr. And I have to tell you that I had never been so impressed, so overwhelmed, and so emotionally moved around this vaccine issue as I was during the course of that conversation. It was mind-boggling. Next, I sit down with Scott and Melissa Miller. They are filmmakers and have a legacy of filmmaking in California. They stumbled across the vaccine issue in a very unique way relative to the anthrax vaccine and the military. You want to see their interview because we're going to be hosting their film, Vaccine Syndrome, in episode 6 of Vaccines Revealed. This is the first time this movie has ever been seen. And then to close out today's episode with some real power, we are screening a 20-minute version of the movie Vaxxed. And Vaxxed is a movie that created quite a dust-up, quite a stir out there in the world and in the media because it was submitted and accepted to be shown in the Tribeca Film Festival, but then was yanked because of the outcry by the media and all these other pseudoscientists who said that people will be hurt if they see this film. Why? Because they might learn something about vaccines that's true that they don't know. So Vax has become an iconic film in this vaccine movement. And I have to tell you that this 20-minute version is very powerful, and we are very proud in Vaccines Revealed to have a strategic alliance with those filmmakers and the people who participated in that film. So enjoy today's episode. Bobby, thanks very much for taking some time to talk to us about this very important subject today. What got you interested in mercury in the first place? I know you've been very active in environmental issues, but how did you specifically get involved in mercury, and then how did it further bring you to vaccines?
I got dragged into the vaccine issue very reluctantly. I was suing coal-burning power plants all across America and the President Waterkeeper Alliance, which is the biggest water protection group in the world. And we have 300 waterkeepers, each one with a patrol boat patrolling local waterways. And a lot of them were involved in litigation against coal-burning power plants, which is one of the biggest air polluters, but also biggest water polluter. And probably besides acid rain and global warming and ozone and particulates, one of the categories of pollutants that is associated with emissions from coal-burning power plants is mercury. And as a result, principally of mercury emissions from coal-burning power plants, there's widespread contamination of fish, particularly freshwater fish in the United States. The FDA has found that every freshwater fish in the United States now has dangerous levels of mercury in its flesh. And largely as a result of that, according to CDC, one out of every 6 American women has enough mercury in their body to create a reduced IQ in their children. So I was litigating at one point against over 30 coal-burning power plants, and I was lecturing around the country. And I was lecturing to large audiences. Almost all the time that I would give a speech, there would be women in the audience who would come up to me afterwards and say, if you're genuinely interested in mercury toxicity and exposure, you need to look at the mercury in vaccines because that is by far the largest vector for exposure, particularly to young children who are the most vulnerable cohort. And this was an issue that I didn't want to get into. I'd always been pro-vaccine. I had all 6 of my children vaccinated. I had no expertise in that area of public health and really very little knowledge about it. But they asked me to read the science, and particularly one woman who approached me, who was a friend of my brother's wife, my sister-in-law, Vicki Kennedy, and her name was Sarah Bridges, and she had a vaccine-injured child who had autism and who had been given a large award, a large settlement from the vaccine court. after 8 years of litigation. And she was very knowledgeable, very smart, and very centered. And she actually gave me some of the science. And she asked me to read it. And I kind of did it as a favor to her and to my sister-in-law. I started reading the science. And one of the features of this issue, one of the kind of Kafkaesque features of this issue, is that most people don't read the science. You know, you hear this absolute insistence by both government agencies and medical doctors and the press that the science has exonerated mercury from any involvement with autism or any of these other neurodevelopmental disorders that we're seeing now epidemic in American children. But when you ask them, what study are you talking about? I have never, literally never, had anybody be able to name me a study that they had read. Oh, even the abstracts people don't read. But I'm very comfortable reading science. My interest in environmental law had started with an interest in science. And I've brought hundreds and hundreds of environmental cases and won them, and almost all of them involve scientific controversy. So if I was not comfortable reading science, I couldn't have, you know, done well in those cases. So I started reading the science, and what I found almost immediately is that, you know, although there was this insistence that there were no studies out there that linked mercury in vaccines to neurodevelopmental disorders, and particularly to autism, that there are actually many, many studies. There were literally hundreds of studies showing that thimerosal was very destructive of brain tissue and caused other human illnesses as well, and animal illnesses, cadaver damage, all this kind of stuff. There was lots and lots of studies out there. There was a very, very rich scientific literature that anybody could access on PubMed. Mm-hmm. But specifically, there were also many studies that linked it to autism, which was shocking because there was such a huge delta between the public perception of what the science said and the government characterization of the science and what the science was actually saying when I read it.
Do you have any premise as to why that is? I mean, why, as you said, this is very searchable, very available, and it's pretty obvious, you know, the connections are there. Yet somehow there's this public perception that the two, that autism and mercury, are not related relative to the vaccine issue. How do you think that disconnect happened?
I think that there's a number of factors, and there, you know, and it's almost like this. It's like when you're talking with the press, it's like dealing with the Borg. You know, it's just this kind of cocoon of denial that really is kind of, it's a journalistic malpractice. But, you know, there are two reasons, I think, principal reasons for it. One is a bad reason, which is there's a huge amount of money going to the pharmaceutical industry from the press.
Yeah.
In fact, the president of one network told me, Fox News, Roger Ailes, who is an old friend of mine, who I spent, you know, a couple of months with in a tent when I was 19 years old in Africa, and I've had this kind of weird friendship with him ever since. He was very sympathetic to the issue, but he said, listen, during some parts of non-election years, a huge portion, I think he said 70% of advertising revenues can come from pharmaceutical companies for the news division. He said, I would have to fire any of my hosts who allowed you on TV if they lost an advertiser. And he said, and if I did that, I would get a call from Rupert within 10 minutes. Mm. So I think that is a consideration. You have, you know, you've had this huge consolidation of the press in our country. There's now essentially six companies that control almost all the newspapers, all the television stations, all the radio stations, and most of the large internet content providers in America. And almost all those companies are getting a very, very large portion of their advertising revenue from the pharmaceutical and from vaccine makers.
Right.
So that's a bad reason. I think that the reporters on the beat, and many of the editors as well, think that they are performing a critical public function, which is to increase vaccination rates. And they believe that the consequence of allowing debate about vaccine safety would be detrimental to public health, and that, you know, actually, I've heard this many times, that we would be killing children. Because if people don't vaccinate, children die. So, you know, you have that, which in some cases, you know, that is a mythology that really needs to be parsed and, explored, and it's not being explored. Unfortunately, the consequence of removing scrutiny from the vaccine industry and from the government officials who regulate it has not been to increase the safety or the popularity of the vaccine program. In fact, the opposite has been true. It has incentivized the worst kind of behaviors by both pharmaceutical companies who are making these vaccines and by the regulators who are often, part of a captive agency phenomena. Yeah. CDC is really part of the vaccine industry. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of the vaccine industry. And that's not hyperbole. CDC is actually buys and sells over $4 billion worth of vaccines annually. And, wow. And if the demand for those vaccines is reduced, there are severe economic consequences for the agency. So they have to sell those vaccines, and they have to create demand for them. And they have the capacity to create demand for them. And both CDC and FDA also are partners in, own vaccine patents. In addition to that, the advisory committees that control the vaccine program are not made up entirely of CDC employees, but they're mainly composed of people who have direct financial ties to the vaccine industry, and in some cases, huge financial incentives to add new vaccines to the schedule. For example, the committee that is in charge of adding new vaccines to the schedule. When I was a boy, I only got 3 vaccines. Mm-hmm. My children got 69 doses of about 20 vaccines. And the committee that adds those new vaccines to the schedule is called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And it's mainly made up of people who are vaccine industry insiders. And I'll give you an example. In 1999, Paul Offit, who is who is a vaccine industry spokesperson and insider, and is on the payroll of Merck, which is the biggest vaccine producer in our country, sat on the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices when it and voted to add the rotavirus vaccine to the schedule. Offit, at that time, was working on a patent for his rotavirus vaccine, and yet he did not recuse himself. They added that vaccine to the schedule. That created a market for an opening for his vaccine, which then became enormously profitable as a direct result of that vote. And he was able to sell that vaccine patent for about $186 million,
wow,
6 years later. And he profited enormously. He's never disclosed how much he made, but looking at the industry practices, it was probably something around the order of $29 million. Oh, that transaction caused a kind of a scandal at HHS and CDC, and the Inspector General of HHS investigated that practice. Mm-hmm. And what they came back and said, that transaction was bad, but it was not illegal under CDC rules. And in fact, up to 97% of the people who sit on that committee may have the same kind of conflicts.
Wow.
They found that 64% actually had the conflicts, but that 97% either had the conflicts or hadn't filled out the paperwork to make the legal disclosures about whether or not they had those conflicts. It's hard to, you know, for Americans who've watched their vaccine schedule increase exponentially to completely have faith that all of these vaccines are being added and to the schedule and then given to their children at a very young age in most cases, simply, you know, because of a narrow focus on public health. When people are actually, you know, making money from these transactions, the people who are making decisions over that vaccine policy are making personal profit on it. And, you know, I think those are conflicts that I think if the American people knew about them, would leave a bad taste in people's mouths.
Yeah, well, it's kind of unprecedented because you have the federal government with taxpayer dollars indemnifying the private vaccine manufacturers in the first place, right? And then you've got people making decisions about the vaccines who have a conflict of interest. And then you have the government agency, the CDC, you know, who basically is becoming, you know, they're distributing the vaccines for them and they have a budget for it that their agency relies upon. I mean, when you look at the constellation that forms, it's pretty disturbing, especially because it's directly affecting, especially children, and what's happening to them.
As I said, when I was a kid, I got three vaccines. My children got up to 69 vaccines. And the schedule changed mainly in 1989. Mm-hmm. The reason it changed is because in 1986, Congress passed the Vaccine Act, which went into effect the following year in 87. The Vaccine Act exempted or immunized, gave blanket immunity to the vaccine industry from any kind of liability. So no matter how reckless they behave, no matter how dangerous or toxic the ingredients or unnecessary the ingredients of the vaccine, no matter how egregious and grievous the injury to the child, no company is liable. Which means not only do they avoid the liability, but they also avoid the discovery, you know, the depositions, the document searches, all those things that would explore and scrutinize the decision-making that are taking place in that vaccine company.
I never thought of that. So there's no discovery on their part either.
No, and the vaccine court doesn't allow any kind of discovery. So, and you want to see how these same companies, these pharmaceutical companies, are behaving when they have this big defense bar looking over their shoulders and suing them and getting, you know, $100 million and $1 billion settlements year after year, or judgments year after year for their pharmaceutical products. Why would that same company behave any differently when it comes to vaccines? Of course, the answer is they don't. Right. The thing is that nobody's looking at them and nobody's allowed to look at them. And not only that, but the Congress not only made it very easy, made them immune from any liability, but they also made it very easy to bring a vaccine to market so you don't have all these kind of burdensome hoops and impediments and testing. You don't have, for example, double-blind placebo testing of big populations that a normal pharmaceutical would have. Some of these products are brought to market with almost no testing whatsoever. When Congress passed that law, prior to that, when I was a boy, nobody was making money on vaccines. In fact, some of the vaccines that I got didn't even have patents. You know, there was almost a civic duty for the pharmaceutical industry. Beginning in 1987, suddenly, you know, this was pay dirt. Vaccines became pay dirt for the industry, and that the Vaccine Act launched a gold rush in the vaccine business, because the vaccine company, the pharmaceutical company, suddenly realized, hey, here's a product. And essentially, effectively, the federal government is requiring 100 million people and state governments, 100 million people, to purchase it. You can't send your kids to school unless they have it. The profit margin was huge. on vaccines, you had no liability. You had no advertising. You had no marketing costs. And there's no consequence to injuring or hurting anybody. So you have this extraordinary product, and there was a rush to add new vaccines to the schedule, and the industry got a hold of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and within a few years they had, you know, not only added all of these vaccines to the schedule, but they had dramatically increased the mercury exposures, and nobody ever did a mass loading analysis of how much mercury is. So the mercury, the typical exposure, mercury exposure to a typical American child went from 70 micrograms per child before age 2 to 237 micrograms. And that year, 1989, you suddenly saw the beginning of this epidemic of neurological disorders that we're seeing among American children today. ADD. All of these diseases that were either rare or unheard of when I was a boy suddenly became epidemic. ADD, ADHD, speech delay, tics, misery disorder, which I'd never heard of before reading it in the scientific literature, on narcolepsy, Tourette's syndrome, tics, which is that family of grave neurological disorders, seizure disorder, and then also anaphylaxis, food allergies, and asthma that happened at the same time. And all of that began and autism and ASD. The autism rates went from 2,500, 1 in 2,500 to 1 today, 1 in 68, as the vaccine schedule expanded. So EPA scientists have identified 1989 as the gateway year, the year that all of these unknown diseases suddenly launched. And, it's clear that, you know, particularly for something like autism, you know, which the scientific literature clearly associates with mercury exposure, not just vaccine mercury, but mercury in fish, mercury acridinia, which was in many ways almost identical, had the same biomarkers as autism, and that was from calomel tooth powders, which were mercurial. Mercury in amalgams, mercury emissions from coal-burning power plants. There are many, many studies that show that the closer you live to a mercury-emitting plant, the higher that your chances are of having autism. So we know that mercury causes it. And suddenly you had this dramatic explosion of autism. And, you know, if somebody says, well, you know, it could be something else, we know it has to be an environmental toxin because it's an epidemic. And genes do not cause epidemics. So genes can create the vulnerability, but you need an environmental toxin. So the question is, what is an environmental toxin that had this dramatic exposure beginning in 1989 across every demographic, from urban blacks and Cuban Americans and whites in Miami, Florida, to Inuit in Homer, Alaska, and everybody in between. Right. Everybody except, incidentally, unvaccinated cohorts like the Amish, who were not getting it. And not only that, you have to also identify a toxin that affects boys on a 4-to-1 ratio to girls. So, you know, people say, well, maybe it's glyphosate, which is from, you know, Roundup, from the pesticide. And certainly, that's not a good thing to put in somebody. It may aggravate autism, and it may cause it itself. But glyphosate was around a lot longer than that. Even the MMR vaccine was, we were giving since the mid-70s. So you have to look, and some people point at that, and that, again, may trigger autism.
Right.
But something else is involved. Something is creating the precondition for it that allows other environmental triggers to trigger it. And, you know, there's very good science that says that if you expose somebody to mercury, that you get these mitochondrial disorders that then can be triggered into autism later on by some other environmental insult. But the mercury is, you know, is the primary culprit.
You have a vast legal background. Is there any other scenario in law relative to the government, et cetera, where this type of a circumstance exists, or is this completely unique where you've got an industry, a multi-billion dollar industry indemnified by the government who's got kind of a get out of jail free card, you know, for all of their actions?
There's nobody who has anything, any deal like this. Yeah. There's no other industry who has this kind of deal where they have a blanket immunity from liability. I mean, the government does indemnify certain industries that, you know, for example, the nuclear power industry has a kind of indemnity as well.
Okay.
Nobody has an indemnity like the pharmaceutical. And, of course, you know, it's been very lucrative for the industry.
Yeah.
This is now a $30 billion industry.
Wow.
And if you can get a vaccine on the schedule, it can be a $1 billion profit, annual profit for your company. So the incentives to get it on there are enormous. And then no liability forever. You know, there's no other pharmaceutical drug that can give you those returns with no liability.
Yeah, it's incredible. Now, you mentioned Dr. Offit earlier, who's a vaccine advocate. You had a personal conversation with him. Could you recount that?
Well, very early on, you know, what I do when I'm trying to learn a new area of science is that I do the reading and then I call the expert. It's very, very hard to just read scientific papers or the abstracts of those papers without somebody to help you understand the context. Different papers have different weight. There's good science and there's bad science, and you can't always spot it without context. So I always call the people on both sides of an issue to try to figure out what the truth is. You know, ultimately, that's what we're trying to do, is to search for existential truths. And I called one of the chief managers at the Institute of Medicine, Kathleen Stratton, and I called Paul Offit very early on after I had done some reading of the science. I had questions about what CDC was saying on its website and its public statements. One of the things that CDC was saying, the principal thing they say, and to this day, it says this on their website, says that we all, you know, one of the big conundrums I think the CDC has is that everybody knows that mercury in fish is bad for you. So in every state and nationally, there are advisories, for example, to pregnant women to only to limit their intake of fish, and particularly certain kinds of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because the methylmercury that is in fish is known to create all kinds of problems with the baby. It's teratogenic, it's mutagenic, it's carcinogenic, it causes low IQ and all these other neurological deficits and disorders. You know, the immediate question that occurred to me, and I'm very familiar with that, immediate question that occurred to me is, how can we be telling mothers not to eat fish, and yet, because of the mercury, and yet we're injecting them and their little babies immediately upon birth with mercury in vaccines, and with doses far higher than the doses we give advisory for on fish, in some cases hundreds of times higher. And so I asked Offit that, and I asked Kathleen Stratton that, and both of them gave me the same story, and it's the story that is on that you can read on CDC's website to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And that story is that, and it's an old industry canard, that ethylmercury is not as toxic as methylmercury because it does not have the residency time in the body. In other words, it's excreted by the body so quickly that it doesn't have time to do any damage.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked Offit for the scientific study that showed that, because the industry's been saying that for 80 years, mm-hmm. with no science. But in 2004, a scientist, a CDC scientist called Picciero, actually did a study mm-hmm. that showed that the mercury in the disappears, the ethyl mercury from vaccines disappears from the blood in about a week. Mm-hmm. Whereas the methyl mercury from fish remains in a child's blood for 54 days.
Okay.
And that superficially tended to support the argument that it leaves, that it's excreted quickly. But that study immediately came under attack because people wrote letters and articles saying, wait a second, Picciero never showed where this mercury was going.
Right.
He didn't find mercury in the feces or the sweat or the fingernails or the hair or the urine of these children. The question is, where is it going?
Right.
Is it really being excreted from the body? And then another scientist about 2 years later, called Thomas Burbacher, and a big team of scientists mm-hmm. did studies on macaque monkeys mm-hmm. where they actually fed them methyl mercury mm-hmm. and then they injected another group with ethyl mercury from vaccines. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that indeed the ethyl mercury from the vaccines disappeared from the macaque blood almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
When they autopsied the macaques, they found it was not leaving the body. The reason it was leaving the bloodstream is because it very easily crossed the blood-brain barrier, wow. and it was going directly to the brain. So rather than proving that it was safe, the capacity of that ethyl mercury to leave the blood quickly was actually evidence of its extraordinary danger, because it was not leaving the children. It was going into their brains. And Burbacher's study showed that it metabolized into a form of mercury that's called organic mercury, mm-hmm. which is the kind that's really toxic, wow. that causes terrible inflammation and neurological death and neurological damage in the brain, and that it metabolized into organic mercury at twice the rate. So it was twice as persistent in the brain as the methyl mercury in fish. And then an Italian scientist called Tozzi a few years later mm-hmm. found that when you measured ethyl mercury against methyl mercury, that ethyl mercury was actually 50 times as toxic as methyl mercury in the brain. The mercury in vaccines is twice persistent and 50 times as toxic as methyl mercury in fish. When I asked Offit the question, how can you say that ethyl mercury in vaccines is safe? He said to me, well, Bobby, we know that it's excreted from the body very quickly. And I said, what study are you talking about? And he cited Picciero, and I said, but have you read Burbacher? There was dead silence on the other end, and it was clear that he did understand the implications of my question. And then he began backtracking, and he said, well, you're right. There are problems with that theory, but it's really a whole mosaic of studies. And that's a quote from him. A whole mosaic of studies that show that the ethyl mercury is safe. And when I asked him what other studies were part of that mosaic, he said that he would get back to me. And that's the last I heard from him. So I knew, and Kathleen Stratton was actually much more honest with me. Kathleen Stratton said, ethyl mercury is bad. When you give thimerosal to mice, it makes them do weird things. When you give it to rats, it causes damage. When you give it to guinea pigs, it makes them act crazy. Clearly, it's not going to be good for humans. That's why we're taking it out of all the vaccines. So that were the two studies. We're taking it out. It's not in them anymore. And even if it was in them, it's excreted. And both of those things are a lie.
So after these conversations with these people who are charged with the public health, who know these things, as you just described, how do you think they live with themselves? I mean, you know, there's literally little children being injured. They have this information, and they're trying to convince you that something is other than what is true.
I see that in the environmental arena a lot. People who are polluting, who seem to be good and decent people. Mm-hmm. And Upton Sinclair said that it's very difficult to convince a man of a fact if the existence of that fact will diminish his salary. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us see the world through a lens of that is at least colored by self-interest.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the transcripts of the Simpsonwood transcripts, mm-hmm. which was the meeting that occurred when they realized, when they, you know, they did a study of the biggest vaccine safety database in America, the healthcare records for hundreds of thousands of children, and they did an internal study in CDC, mm-hmm. and they realized that they were causing the autism epidemic. This is 2001. Mm-hmm. They had a secret meeting off campus at CDC so that it couldn't be what they thought it would be immune from Freedom of Information Law requests. And they had that meeting with 75 vaccine makers and key officials from all of the federal agencies, from FDA, from CDC, from NIH, the World Health Organization, et cetera, to decide how to handle this information. And it's really a fascinating study in human character. And my father was very interested, you know, who was kind of a contemporary of World War II, and had been in the Navy, you know, during the last year of the war. And very affected by, you know, the discoveries about what the Nazis had done. He was always interested in how the circumstances that made good and decent people participate in Holocausts and calamities, you know, and catastrophes. And you see that in that transcript. You see it happening because when they first get the information, all of these people are horrified. Mm. You know, there's one of them, a famous Dr. Neil Halsey, who literally cried. Mm. And they say, you know, how could this have happened? They say, were we asleep at the wheel? Why didn't we, this is childhood math, why didn't we look at these mercury loads? You know, when we ordered all these new vaccines, how come we never did a mass loading analysis of the amount of mercury exposure that we were going to be giving to these kids? And there's a lot of mea culpas. Mm-hmm. And you have people at that time, we have an email trail as well, like Ruth Edsel, who is saying, we got to come clean. We've got to do the right thing. We've got to tell the American people. We've got to do our mea culpas. We've got to express our regret, our apology, and then we have to start rebuilding the credibility of the vaccine program. But by the second day of that meeting, these other voices had begun to assert themselves. And people say, well, if we do this, the lawyers will come out of the woodwork and they'll sue us. And, you know, more importantly, they'll sue the vaccine companies, the pharmaceutical companies. And the implication was the pharmaceutical companies would just stop producing vaccines. And then, you know, they begin to coalesce and say, we've got to hide this. We've got to keep this quiet. And by the end of the second day, all of these people, these, you know, mature, you know, public servants, suddenly at the end of that meeting, they're saying to each other, we've got to embargo this. We've got to hide this from the American people. And that's what they did. There's one very poignant moment where Robert Johnson, who's, I think, the head of the Children's Hospital in Denver, or a similar hospital, stands up in the meeting and says, my daughter-in-law just had our first male grandson of our family line, and I'm not going to give him a vaccine. Now, as long as there's thimerosal in it, I'm not going to give it to them. So they were telling each other, we know this is dangerous. You know, we know what this study says. It's unambiguous. You can't massage it. There's nothing you can do. It's real. And then they're saying, we got to hide it. And then there's an email trail for the next year and a half coming out of IOM and CDC saying, how do we create new studies that will justify our point of view, that will show that there's no problems with, that there's no connection between autism and these other diseases. And so, you know, you saw that, you see that whole, that cascade occur where the human behavior, the worst instincts, suddenly the survival instincts take hold.
It's really almost unimaginable, especially because you're saying this is documented. I mean, it's not like...
That's very well. I mean, not we hearsay. Have the, the vaccine program changed in 1989, around 1989, and the years after. And by the mid-1990s, they were seeing this cascade, this explosion of these epidemiological or these neurological, neurodevelopmental disorders. So CDC had a giant repository of child health information. It's called the Vaccine Safety Database, and they spend $20 million a year maintaining this database, and it's exactly precisely for reasons like this so that you can do epidemiological studies and identify the toxins, you know, if there are some that are causing problems. So they brought in an in-house epidemiologist whose name was Thomas Verstraten, who started looking at the data. And his initial runs of the data were very clear that, yes, these new vaccine schedules, particularly the thimerosal, was causing the autism epidemic. He looked at the kids who had received 25 micrograms and less of thimerosal and compared those to kids who had 25 micrograms or more and found a 760 relative risk. That means a 760% greater chance for the higher exposed group to get an autism diagnosis. One of the runs, he found an 1,100 relative risk, 11.5 relative risk. And that's greater than the association between smoking a pack of cigarettes every day for 20 years and cancer. So they knew at that point what was causing the autism epidemic. Not only that, but they found similar associations for ADD, ADHD, tics, a speech delay, and a number of other neurodevelopmental disorders. Then clearly Verstraten came under a lot of pressure to try to change those results. And you see these emails back and forth saying, it just won't go away. speaking of the autism signal and him talking about, you know, about how he's massaging the data and pushing it this way, but that whenever he pushes it this way, the signal continues to persist. And then they have the Simpsonwood meeting. And after the Simpsonwood meeting, you see this flood of emails saying, let's go to other countries, you know, countries where there's lower exposures of thimerosal. And let's do epidemiological studies. Now, the Institute of Medicine had said that the link between autism and vaccines and thimerosal is, quote, biologically plausible. They instructed the CDC to do a range of studies, toxicological studies, biological studies, and clinical studies, and, you know, animal studies, et cetera. The CDC has never done any of those studies. Instead, CDC commissioned a series of epidemiological studies that mainly took place in foreign countries where the exposures to thimerosal were much less to start off with. And they took advantage of changing reporting requirements in those countries that gave the illusion that, for example, in Scandinavia, when thimerosal was banned in 1993, the autism levels actually climbed after the ban. So this was something CDC jumped on. The reason they climbed, however, was not because the incidence of autism was actually climbing, but it was an artifact of changing reporting requirements. Yeah. Prior to 1993, the Danish government had only required inpatient cases of autism to be reported to the National Disease Registry. Every nation has a National Disease Registry, every developed nation, so that it's a registry of contagious diseases. So that, for example, if you live in California and you go into your doctor with a measles case, he has to report that to the Department of Health. It's mandatory reporting. And for obvious reasons, we want to know where these, you know, contagious diseases exist and how they're spreading. So, but autism in Scandinavia was never on that registry. It was never a mandatory reported disease because it wasn't contagious. So the only autism cases that were required to be reported were those people who were so debilitated by autism that they had to live inpatient. You know, they were permanently hospitalized, essentially. So, and that was about 8% of the total cases. But in 1993, because autism was exploding in Scandinavia, again, because they had changed their vaccine schedule, they made it mandatory for everybody to report because they wanted to see what was happening in the numbers the same year that they banned thimerosal.
Wow.
Because of that, the amount that the disease registry showed that it looked like the number of cases of autism were actually increasing after thimerosal was banned. And CDC took advantage of that, and they sent a very, very corrupt data manager over there to make it look like the incident of autism was actually increasing. The data manager's name was Paul Thornton, and he actually stole the $1 million that CDC had given him to do this study. And he's now on the run in Europe. He's the FBI and the Justice Department have issued a 22-count indictment against him for fraud and for wire theft. Mm-hmm. And he's on the run from Interpol and the FBI in Europe. But CDC continues to tout that study as proof that thimerosal does not cause autism.
To this day, they're still touting.
Yeah, to this day.
Now, you have filed suit against the CDC.
Well, what we've done is we filed a suit on asking the CDC to produce, to allow us to depose its senior vaccine safety scientist, whose name is Dr. William Thompson. Mm-hmm. And Dr. William Thompson has come forward and said on tape and also in a public statement that CDC has been essentially defrauding the public, has been manipulating data, destroying data, massaging data in its vaccine studies in order to deceive the American public and the public health community about the safety of thimerosal and, and other vaccines.
Wow. And because they've not let him testify or make a statement.
To this date, they are not allowing Dr. Thompson to speak publicly.
I found an irony because I had some email exchange with Dr. Thompson recently, and on the bottom in the CDC signature, it says, "Saving lives, protecting people," as their slogan. And it seems, you know, extraordinarily ironic in a tragic way that you want to try to get him to come out and talk about the things that he needs to be talking about.
Well, you know, a lot of people, I think their first reaction is, you know, this couldn't be true.
Right.
Why would the CDC do this? You know, why would they lie to us about the safety of vaccines? And, you know, it is astonishing. And you almost have to read the Simpsonwood transcripts to understand, you know, what happened to the CDC and why these idealistic public servants, you know, suddenly felt that they had to close ranks and protect the institution. But, you know, in many ways, we see the analogies for this behavior in other realms, for example, the Catholic Church and the pedophile scandal.
Right.
You know, that everybody got involved in it. Everybody got implicated in it. You know, there was a relatively small number of priests who were actually raping children. Mm-hmm. But the bishops, you know, got involved because suddenly the institution became more important than the children that they were supposed to be protecting.
Right.
And it's the same thing here. And there, you know, the CDC and the vaccine program have to be protected. And at you know, these people who are being injured are just sacrifices for the greater good. So, you know, I think they got involved in that kind of perverse dynamic. But that at the time when they make these choices, they seem like rational choices to them and necessary choices. And they don't seem selfish and they don't seem evil to the person who's making it. But now, when we look at it from the outside, it's astonishing.
It is astonishing, and it's what I find. And you're the only person, and I've been having many conversations around all these issues. But I think this is the only time that I've really captured kind of the social dynamic and the psychodynamics around how people can collectively start to get on a certain track of thinking, and almost, you know, trick themselves into thinking what they're doing is good. And the other references historically that show that this is not necessarily unprecedented, that human beings would convene and do this and convince themselves of such
a
thing.
Yeah, I mean, and it happened, you know, the same thing happened in many, many contexts. The NFL concussion scandal is
right.
another example. But throughout history, in fact, there's a word for it, which is called the Semmelweis effect. Mm-hmm. And it describes the same thing that happened to a doctor called Ignaz Semmelweis, who was the first person to advance theories of hygiene. Mm-hmm. Because he saw that women in hospitals in Austria were becoming very, very, were dying. Women who came in for childbirth were dying. And he realized that the people who were doing the autopsies were not cleaning their hands. Mm-hmm. Between doing that autopsy and actually delivering babies. Yeah. And that the women, they were carrying something. This was before germ theory.
Right.
That they were carrying something with them from those corpses that was making the women sick. And it was killing huge numbers of them. I think 30 or 40% were dying.
Wow.
in these hospitals. And he instituted these, he did a study and instituted what we describe today as normal hygiene practices. Mm-hmm. And it reduced the numbers of death exponentially. He then published a paper on it, and he was absolutely condemned and destroyed by the medical community. He said, no, because who did not want to recognize that doctors who believed themselves to be people who were saving lives were actually contributing to these injuries and deaths. And he lost his license, and he was locked in a mental institution where he died mysteriously, you know, 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've seen this throughout history. And it happens. And Paul Offit, when he spoke to me, he talked to me about how much he admired my father and how, you know, it was my father's inspiration that led him to get into public service. And Kathleen Stratton said the same kind of things to me. So, and I felt, you know, these are people who started out as idealistic and good people who are trying to help children. But they somehow got sucked into this vortex where they began justifying to themselves behaviors and conducts that, you know, were ultimately socially malevolent.
Where do you hope to take this now as far as, you know, do you look to hold the CDC to account or any of these people to account? And what's the outcome that we can hope for?
The most important outcome, I think, that, you know, that the strategic outcome would be to get a public debate about this.
Yes.
Because the CDC cannot withstand a public debate. Mm-hmm. So all the things that I do are are bent on forcing this debate out into the open, because once the science is in the open, the CDC's position is so fragile. And it's an edifice of fraud stacked upon fraud, and so high and so wobbly that even a slight breeze of public scrutiny will topple it. But that, you know, the genius of what they've been able to do is to be able to stop all of that public scrutiny. And it's not only Congress that, you know, won't investigate them, and the regulatory agencies have been captured. The courts and the lawyers that would normally apply that scrutiny have been removed by the Vaccine Act. And the press has been compromised. You know, and it's not just the mainstream corporate media, but also the so-called alternate media like Huffington Post and, you know, Salon and Slate and Daily Beast and even Mother Jones, that, you know, for whom this is a tabooed topic. They simply will not cover it. They will not allow editorials. They won't allow letters. They won't allow any discussion. So, and it's, and that is really this Kafkaesque, you know, cocoon. And they've made it so that, you know, Daniel Shulman wrote in the Columbia Law Review, or the Journalism Review, that for journalists, this is radioactive, that this is a career-ending a controversy. So reporters won't touch it. No, everybody is scared of it. And, you know, doctors won't come out. Doctors lose their license if they talk about this. The scientific journals won't publish on it, you know, and they, because they get directly punished. Their revenues are largely coming from pharmaceutical companies. So they've effectively been able to shut off any kind of controversy. And you know, of course, when you know, mushrooms and cockroaches need darkness in order to flourish, and that's what happens. And then they, you know, they explode, their populations explode exponentially. So what we need is sunlight.
Yeah.
If you put a little sunlight on this controversy, the whole thing's going to fall apart. And that's all of my strategies, the lawsuits, you know, the articles, the public statements, the demonstrations, everything is about trying to have a debate in our democracy. And it's been, you know, of course, it's very frustrating, but it's a phenomena. You know, I've never seen anything like this in my life where you're simply not allowed to talk about it. And the only places where it's being talked about, but it's on the social media, and it's all sub rosa, and it's shows like this one, you know, which will never air on HBO, will never air on the public media, on the mainstream media. You know, it's all, you know, and that's what we have to do. We have to get the social media so active that there's a crack, there's a break. The thing is that it is going to, we will win this. Because all it takes is, there are many, many ways. It's like storming a fortress, you know, and every time you storm, you lose troop. You're probing for that one crack.
Right.
And it could be just one editor of the Atlanta Constitution who says, you know what, we're going to do a series on corruption at CDC. Or a producer at 60 Minutes or the Today Show who says, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm not going to be censored anymore. I'm going to allow a debate on this. Or it could be a lawsuit. A judge who says, you know, I've looked at the facts in this. I know something about science, and there's something really screwy here. And I'm going to, you know, allow William Thompson to be deposed publicly. It could be a congressman who subpoenas him before a committee and expose the whole thing and force a debate. As soon as that debate happens, you know, the opposition to this will shrivel. But that's what you need. You need sunlight. You need debate. We live in a democracy, and it's absolutely insane that we're not allowed to talk about this.
Do you feel like in the ranks that you described that this has become like a form of a religion, the vaccine thing, and that nobody can speak
against? Yeah, it is. It's orthodoxy. And like all orthodoxies, it's cruel and it's often lethal. It's a, you know, it behaves like, it's certainly not science. Nobody's looking at the science. Everything is taken on faith and nobody's allowed to challenge it. Nobody's allowed to talk about it. Nobody's allowed to debate it. Mm. You have to accept the received knowledge of, you know, these higher powers, which is CDC. Now, where else does the press allow, you know, these, you know, a government power to tell it what the science says? Why isn't a reporter actually reading the science and say, wait a minute, it doesn't say this at all?
Right.
And then anybody who questions that orthodoxy has to be destroyed. And you see this viciousness towards, you know, the mothers of vaccine-injured children who are vaccine-hesitant parents. Mm. These people aren't naturopaths and crackpots. You know, as they've been described,
right,
they're all marginalized and dismissed and vilified as a very misogynistic, you know, impulse. You know, that because these are mainly women, right, who are making these complaints, and these women know what happened to their child.
Right.
They brought a perfectly healthy 2-year-old into their pediatrician and got a battery of shots, and that night that baby spikes a fever. And this is a child who exceeds all milestones. And I've heard this story 1,000 times. Mm. In language, in social interaction, in athletic ability, that child exceeds his cohorts, his year class. And she brings him in at age two. She gives him this battery of shots. A lot of these mothers were hesitant. They saw all these needles going to the baby. They questioned the doctor. The doctor says, okay. At night, the baby spikes a fever, maybe has a seizure, and over the next 3 months, the child is lost. They lose the ability to interact with their brothers and sisters, to point their finger, to make eye contact. Mm-hmm. They begin engaging in stereotypical behavior, the headbanging, the flapping, the unrealized clapping, and they lose their language. They become nonverbal. They lose their toilet training, you know, and now you have a kid who's, you know, maybe at this point 14-year-old, still wearing diapers and wearing a football helmet and screaming in agony. And this was a totally normal child. That never happened in history before. There's no recording of this, you know, in my generation. Nobody ever described perfectly normal children who suddenly regress into, you know, intellectual disability. And these mothers who know what happened, they know, and they're dismissed as crackpots and naturopaths and hysterics and refrigerator moms and all this, you know, all of these things that are said about these, instead of saying, wait a minute, this is the parent of an intellectually disabled child, and we ought to listen to her. We ought to hear what she's saying. We ought to not just dismiss her theories about what happened to that child. We need to listen, we need to examine, we need to scrutinize, and we need to see if what she's saying is true. But none of that happens. None of that happens. It's all that, you know, this whole body of thousands and thousands of women are just dismissed, and you see what happens to them and to their families, and you know, these were the women I was meeting on the road, and they're courageous, and they're smart, and they're well informed, and you know, they know what the science says, and they've attended the meetings, and they've read the government documents, and they've read the Simpsonwood transcripts, and you know, and they weren't anti-vaccine. They vaccinated their kid.
Right.
But they saw what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, part of this, and that's what happens in orthodoxies. Orthodoxies are cruel. Mm-hmm. Anywhere you see them, they are ultimately cruel. Because, you know, we've got to be able to question things.
That's right.
We have to be able to ask the questions. And, you know, science is not religion. And you can't just say, I believe in it, no matter what it says, no matter how mean it is, no matter how cruel it is, mm-hmm. no matter how ruthless or damaging it is to children. You know, we've just got to do what it says. Mm-hmm. We've got to obey CDC, you know. In the New York Times, you know, listen to you know, undeserving authority to government officials in the run-up to the Iraq War. They had to apologize for it.
Yeah.
And the damage that did to our country, You know, if that one paper had asked the questions at that time and applied the scrutiny that the press, that journalists are supposed to apply, we may have avoided that crisis, and we wouldn't be in Syria today, and Europe wouldn't be in disarray, and, you know, we wouldn't be bankrupt and all of these other issues.
Yeah.
It's amazing. If they had done that. And what they've done, what that same paper has done with thimerosal, is probably 10 times worse. Because, you know, there's 100 million kids a year that are being exposed to this, and the New York Times will not allow any discussion on it.
Wow. As a final thought for the people who are watching this, and I'm somewhat in stunned silence just, you know, listening to what you're saying, because the power of the thoughts is, you know, shakes me to my core because of the implications it has in our, not just today, but in our future and future generations. So people are watching this now. What actions should they take? What do you think people should do? How can they activate?
We're going to beat these people. I feel, I've spent my life working on energy issues, and environmental issues, and global warming and rivers. But I've have taken a hiatus to do just this issue because I cannot stand by and watch these children be poisoned. You know, an entire generation of kids that is being poisoned now by, you know, government policies and greed, and we are going to take them on and beat them. And, you know, we need help. We're at the World Mercury Project. We need your support. We need financial support. We need members, because we're going to sue government agencies. We're going to sue pharmaceutical companies. We're suing the people. We're figuring out different ways to litigate this. But we need member in order to, for a charitable group to litigate, we need to show that we have members who have standing.
Right.
So, you know, we need everybody to join up, to go to our website and to join and then, you know, write the president.
Right.
Write the president letters. I know that that President Trump actually is interested in this issue, and he reads people's letters who write him about this. Write him and write your member of Congress and, you know, and write to your newspaper and try to get them to start covering this issue, honestly.
So they can go to worldmercuryproject.org, and there they can sign up as a member, donate, and take
and
that
And we will also give you action alerts. We'll tell you things that you ought to be doing.
That's terrific. Well, can I just say on behalf of myself and many, many other people who have a great interest in this issue, I want to thank you for all the work that you've done. I also want to thank you for letting us invade your home today and sit down and have this conversation with you and allow us to record it and to share it with others. It's been very, very meaningful, and I know it's going to make a difference. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so let's start out. Just to please introduce yourself and tell us what you do.
My name is Scott Miller. I'm a director. I come from a long list of filmmakers, if you will. My father's name is Warren Miller. He's done over 800 extreme sports movies. I shot a student film at Art Center College of Design that was qualified for an Academy Award in the short film category, which got me an honorary degree from Art Center. When I was at Art Center, we had great teachers. We had Ansel Adams. We had Francesca Scavullo. We had people of that ilk. And I was a fine artist at that school. I was not in the film business. And from there, I went to Wide World of Sports for a year and went around the world traveling, shooting sports films. And then realized that the movie business was something I really was going to relish as a director. And I moved into a very lucrative business in those days, which was high-end corporate image campaigns for commercials. And I did that for a number of years, won all sorts of awards. Probably most of the clients that used to advertise you, and we did all of their stuff. We were very in demand. And this particular film bit me by accident.
So the original story that got this going, can you tell me what that story was?
Well, originally it was because it was, quite frankly, as a filmmaker, it was great drama. I didn't realize what I was getting myself into until we finished it and got such not a whiplash, but a whole bunch of information from military members.
I'm Melissa Mosich Miller. I'm Scott Miller's wife, and I'm the producer on this film, and I was also a writer and voiceover. You know, you have a visceral reaction to this kind of information and dealing with these kinds of stories because there's so much heartache. But there's another side to it, and that is how extraordinary our military personnel are. They're smart. They are interested in other people. They're generous, completely generous. They'd give their life. And so you have an obligation. And I approach the film, my working with the film, I work very closely with a researcher and associate producer, Bob Lee, to get at information. And that information is fascinating. And you learn a lot in this film. I learned a lot, and I wanted the audience to learn a lot so that they can make their own decisions about things. So we have a very narrow group in the military. You can watch it. You can know that it's the vaccine and that. But you have a big, broad pharmaceutical industry, military, government that is making these decisions. And they'll be making them for, you know, everybody, not just first responders like firemen and, you know, our Coast Guard and our, you know, all of our militaries, but they're going to be making them for all of us, for citizens. And we need to, what I wanted the film to show, and when we were working on the writing, I wanted people to see the process so they could see the thought processes that go into this. And unfortunately, one of the overriding thought processes is how can we make money off these things?
This one will tell the story, and it does tell the story right. It's the only film that I've really went out of my way to not manipulate.
This movie, Vaccine Syndrome, you get sent a lot of stuff. I get sent a lot of stuff. Saying no is like, you get inundated with it. So I'm automatically jaded. I see this come across. I get from Scott a link to see this film. Of course, I knew who Scott was as a filmmaker, but even still, it's just, there's no way to fit this in. I think I talked to you about it. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I start this. I'm going to watch 30 minutes of it and go to bed. I'll be able to say, yeah, I took a look at it. It doesn't really fit. I watched 30 minutes of it, and I was hooked. I watched, and literally an hour and a half later, I'm sitting at my counter in my kitchen at the island, tears streaming down my face. I had forgotten the military. We focused on the children, the mandatory vaccination program, but the other epicenter is the military, where we're vaccinating all of these, and we've got 18-year-old muscle-strong kids that are the healthiest kids in our country, and we're killing these kids. So I'm watching what they expose in this, the fraud and the corruption and the greed. It literally was jaw-dropping. And that night, I emailed you and said, guys, you have to look at this. It has to be a part of it. I really want to make sure that everybody in the country who knows anybody in the military, cares about anybody in the military, or cares about our military, sees this film. It's critically important. So it's why you and I are here, why we shoehorned this into Vaccines Revealed, is because it's that important that people see this.
Freedom. It is the soldier, not the reporter, who has given us the freedom of the press.
Got over 5,000 men from a force of 40,000 who were ill.
They kicked me out.
It is the soldier, not the poet, who has given us the freedom of speech.
We're going on 40-some-odd months now of non-stop, 24-7 screaming in my ears.
It is the soldier, not the campus organizer, who has given us the freedom to demonstrate.
It takes a few months to get before the effects of the anthrax vaccine really get going.
This is an experiment.
It is the soldier who serves beneath the flag.
I can't have Gulf War syndrome because I never actually went out to the Gulf.
There are no safe vaccines at all.
Whose coffin is draped by the flag.
For every one individual that comes forward, there are three individuals that will not.
Who salutes the flag.
My hands prevent me from operating.
My officers were right up there with God and Corps.
The inoculations I received are classified secret.
We had an inordinate amount of people who were sick.
Who allows a protester to burn the flag.
I have a real bad feeling on this.
It is the soldier, not the politician, who has given his blood.
I was no longer deployable because I would not take the vaccine.
His body.
All I know is I feel used and abused and left to rot in the streets.
His life. Freedom.
We are not the enemy.
He was proud of being a Marine.
The Secretary of Defense says this is a lawful order. The entire chain of command, the Joint Chiefs say this is a lawful order.
They actually done this to us.
Yeah, you know, we checked this out and we think it's a lawful order and we're not going to let it go to court.
If there was such a secret study being conducted that those responsible for it must be held accountable and it should never be allowed to happen again.
Use this as guinea pigs.
It is the soldier who serves beneath the flag, who salutes the flag, whose coffin is draped by the flag, who allows a protester to burn the flag.
Each man or woman would say, I was perfectly healthy.
The anthrax vaccine program ended my flying career.
And I took the anthrax vaccine and I immediately became ill.
Blood was coming out my nose, my ears, my bowels. And I was just too sick to do anything.
It is the soldier, not the politician, who has given his blood, his body, his life, who has given us these freedoms.
In California, the worst measles outbreak in 15 years is spreading.
The virus is roaring back into the headlines tonight. An outbreak somehow traced to
someone who had probably caught measles abroad, visited Disneyland, and may have sneezed.
Measles on the march in America.
This outbreak is showing no signs of letting up. There are already more cases this year than there were.
The number tripled to 644 measles cases reported in 27 states.
And I mean, is this all basically because of the anti-vaccination movement? Because parents aren't vaccinating their kids?
Yeah, you know, I think so.
A bill that would ban exemptions from childhood vaccines is advancing through the California legislature.
We are authoring legislation that will abolish the personal belief exemption.
I think you're starting to see why it is that mandates are so important.
There has been some inaccurate information circulating about vaccines, mostly stemming from a British study linking vaccines to autism.
The bill requiring children to be vaccinated has passed with bipartisan support. Every child must meet immunization standards before joining public schools, private schools, and daycares.
I would strongly encourage everybody, look at the science, look at the facts. CDC, the Center for Disease Control, can give you good information. Get your children vaccinated.
I have waited a long time to tell my story, and I want to tell it truthfully. I was involved in deceiving millions of taxpayers regarding the potential negative side effects of vaccines. We lied about the scientific findings. The CDC can no longer be trusted to do vaccine safety work. Can't be trusted to be transparent. The CDC can't be trusted to police itself. Just a few thoughts. William W. Thompson, Senior Scientist, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Oh.
Hello.
I was sitting at my desk where I teach at Simpson University. My phone rings, and it's Dr. William Thompson.
Brian, you and I don't know each other very well. I don't know how this is all going to play out. You have a son with autism, and I have great shame now when I meet families with kids with autism, because I have been part of the problem.
My son, Stephen, was born in February of 1998.
Steve, what does the cow say?
Tweet, tweet.
Doggy.
Doggy.
Yeah. 2 weeks after his 15-month vaccines, then he lost all language. He lost all eye contact. You'd pick him up and he would just hang limp. Fast forwarding to 2014, Thompson said to me, Brian, if you listen to me, I can guarantee you will be able to access a treasure trove of data.
So I want to be a resource. I want to be valuable to you. I want you to have someone in the system.
For years, I had been trying to crack this edifice of the CDC and just getting little glimpses of what was not right.
The CDC has put the research 10 years behind. Because the CDC has not been transparent, we've missed 10 years of research because the CDC is so paralyzed right now by anything related to autism.
We begin, though, as always, keeping them honest. Breaking news tonight, just hours ago, the British medical journal BMJ did something extremely rare for a scientific journal. It accused a researcher, Andrew Wakefield, of outright fraud.
I got a call on the 19th of May, 1995, from a mother telling me the story of her child, his regression into autism following a vaccine. And I said, how can I help you? I know nothing about autism. You've come through to the wrong number. And she said, no, doctor, my child has terrible gastrointestinal issues and no one will take them seriously. I was an academic gastroenterologist doing research with a particular interest in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, inflammatory bowel disease. I knew nothing whatsoever about autism. When I was at medical school, it was so rare, we weren't taught about it. We heard a succession of stories which were very, very similar. Medicine is about pattern recognition, and there was a clear pattern emerging. So we decided, a group of us, including the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologists at the time, led by Professor John Walker Smith, decided that these children merited thorough investigation.
Well, Dr. Wakefield has been shown used absolutely fraudulent data. He created a fake paper. The journal allowed it to run. All the other studies were done, showed no connection whatsoever again and again and again. So it's an absolute lie that has killed thousands of kids.
And what we discovered and reported for the first time was this link between what appeared to be a novel type of intestinal inflammation and autistic regression in previously developmentally normal children. And among those, the majority had regressed into autism, according to their parents, following the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. It wasn't our place to censor their story because it may be uncomfortable for public health. Our job was to report that story accurately in order that it might lead to further investigation. And the paper explicitly said, this paper does not prove an association between MMR vaccine and the syndrome described. More work is needed to resolve this issue. That was the conclusion of the paper.
As an investigative medical journalist, I've spent the last 7 years working on one of the best medical talk shows in the world. We know in medicine that there have been many, many studies proving that vaccines do not cause autism. But the problem I have always had with that is thousands and thousands of parents all telling the same story. My child got a vaccine, usually the MMR vaccine, and then that night or the next day broke out in a fever. And then when they came out of the fever, lost speech, lost the ability to walk, basically regressed into what we know as autism, and never came back.
When a CDC scientist who'd been there at that time 17 years tells you This is how you access data. It didn't take me very long to realize, oh, I better do what he says because he knows what he's talking about.
I just want to tell you one thing. Right now, I'm sitting in a very pretty position in terms of providing you a lot of information.
He asked me, what data sets are you going to request? And I said, well, I'm going to request two of the studies that you've done on Thimerosal, the mercury-containing preservative that's used in some of the vaccines. And he said, well, that's fine, but I want you to request the MMR data set first. And this is the study by Frank DiStefano and his colleagues in 2004.
It was the one study where we could end up creating a mess while the CDC tried to sort out something they couldn't understand.
The day Billy got the MMR was a living nightmare. It was worse than my life, to be honest with you.
I came in and I saw him lying in his cot, listless. He started this uncontrollable shaking. Imagine coming out of a frozen pond.
His eyes were doing this and he was shaking like this.
And I remember she grasped him and held him really tight to her chest.
There's immediate fear in John and there's immediate, mummy, this is not going to happen. I don't know what is wrong with you, but this is not going to happen. And we get to hospital, we rush him in, doctors are coming in and looking at him, and that's when they said, he's had a reaction, he's had a seizure, this is normal, this is common for many, many children who have this vaccination. It's absolutely okay, he's going to be fine. Nobody ever told me that there would be any side effect to any of the vaccinations my children had.
Following his febrile convulsion that he had the same day of the MMR, we were told to take him home.
He slept in the bed with us for the night. He seemed just very, very sleepy. In fact, he didn't really ever wake up to the Billy that we had before.
My oldest son, Ian, was born normal, developing normally. He was this beautiful boy, and we ended up at our 12-month visit, which is his 1 year. Then they gave him multiple vaccines at once. And within 7 days, he had a 104 fever and a rash all over his body. He had previously been noted in our videos, home videos, that he was walking and actually running at that point. 7 days after the vaccine, he was no longer able to do that. Falling down, he became a really sick, sick little boy.
So the question for those of us investigating autism is age of exposure to MMR a risk for autism? And in order to understand why that might be, you have to understand something of the history of MMR vaccine. In 1987, there was an MMR vaccine that was being used in Canada, produced by SmithKline Beecham. And that vaccine caused meningitis. It was recognized quickly, and that vaccine was withdrawn in Canada. However, in the same month that it was withdrawn in Ontario, it was licensed in the UK. The name was simply changed from Trivirix to Pluserix. In the UK, it was used for 4 years, and likewise, it caused meningitis and had to be rapidly withdrawn. There was a public outcry. There was an acute loss of confidence by the public in vaccine policymakers, and the vaccine should, at that point, have been destroyed. It wasn't. It was then shipped to developing countries like Brazil, where it was used in a mass vaccination campaign. And there was an epidemic of meningitis, which was entirely predictable.
The Institute of Medicine is a body of scientists and physicians that review the available data on vaccine safety and then advise our government on vaccine research policy. Well, because Andy Wakefield had put forth this theory that the age at which you receive the MMR may increase your risk of autism, the IOM looked to the CDC to do that very study. It was a study about timing. Does the earlier you receive the MMR vaccine increase the risk of autism?
The CDC, the way that they do research studies is very reactionary. They look at something that's creating a press and creating a buzz that could actually lower vaccination rates, and that's what they study. They don't study vaccines proactively.
All I recommended was that parents opt for the use of the single vaccines, single measles, single mumps, single rubella, until the issue had been resolved scientifically. What happened when I made that recommendation? Unilateral decisions were made by the government in the UK to withdraw the importation license for the single vaccines, Merck opting in the US to cease the production of the single vaccines, giving parents no option. I said to a senior representative of the Department of Health, why, if your objective is to protect children against serious infectious disease, why would you take away the option of how parents do that? And she said, because if we allowed parents the choice of single vaccines, it would destroy our MMR program. In other words, the concern was for the protection of the program over and above the protection of children.
No one's career has ever been advanced in the medical industrial complex by being outwardly and openly critical of the vaccine industry. I'm Mark Blaxall, father of a daughter diagnosed with autism back in 1998. I've written two books that have come out of the autism movement, have been projected into autism advocacy ever since. Mikhail was born typical, everything was fine, was developing normally through her first birthday. We have vivid memories of early language, joint attention, lots of play. She was adorable, beautiful, cute. And then somewhere in the months after, she began to slip away and she lost language and she began to retreat into a world of her own. And at 2 years, 9 months, we got a formal diagnosis of a full syndrome autism. It was a hopeless, pessimistic future that was laid out in front of us. She was going to be disabled for the rest of her life, likely to be non-vocal in an institution, and that the best thing we could do was to accept the inevitable. Part of the story we heard from the Harvard experts was autism was genetic. It was low and relatively constant prevalence. The more I learned, the more clear was that that whole orthodox view was false, completely false. Revolutions only happen in science when there is an anomaly that the old orthodoxy can't explain. With autism, the anomaly was the explosion in cases, which meant that what people were trying to describe as a genetic, neurologically based condition couldn't be genetic. It could only be environmental. It could only be some set of things that had happened to children. And you had to ask the question, what might it have been?
When I originally got the MMR autism data, I came up with my own analysis plan, and I stepped through logically and systematically how the data should have been approached. I looked, first of all, at males versus females. Then I looked at black males. The relative risk of them receiving an autism diagnosis was astronomical, and it was highly statistically significant. I really had to scratch my head and say, I know nothing about the MMR vaccine. And so that's when I originally called Andy.
Wow. Really? After everything that had happened, everything we'd all been through, everything that the families had suffered for the last 15 years, and the CDC had known all along there was this MMR autism risk.
As I started to divulge more of the conversations, then I think it really hit him that this was a major crack in the wall of the CDC.
The first thing that Thompson did was to plot a graph of percentage of children vaccinated against age at first MMR vaccination. The children with autism are represented by the pink line, the children without autism by the blue line. Now, if there's no link between early MMR and autism, those two lines should track together, whatever the age at first MMR. Now, they do track together until they get to 15 months, and then they separate, and they continue to separate thereafter.
This was their first indication that MMR vaccine was causing autism.
And that finding alone rocked Thompson back on his heels.
Bill Thompson looked at African Americans. He saw that those African Americans that got the MMR on time were 2.64 times more likely to get an autism diagnosis than those African Americans that received the MMR after 3 years of age.
Just like the African American children, they went into the room and they sliced and diced the data in an effort to get rid of that effect.
This is Colleen Boyle's meeting notes, how they plan to present the data by these age groups. But after the fact, when the data are in, she writes reformat, and then she puts in new age groups. Even this failed to achieve the desired effect, since in the end they simply omitted the relevant findings from the paper altogether.
I was just looking at that, I'm like, oh my God, I cannot believe we did what we did. But we did.
Yeah.
So it's all there. It's all there.
I take him to see the pediatrician that I know. And she looks at me, she closes the door, and she whispers, she says, Sheila, I believe he has autism. I said, what? Like Rain Man? She says something like that. I'm going to refer you out to a neurologist. And we go see the neurologist the next week. He says he has every classical symptom of autism. I do not believe this. I was angry. When he was explaining to me what Canis autism is, he told me he was born that way. I said, no, he wasn't.
I am a senior research scientist here at MIT in the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. I have a bachelor's degree in biology from MIT, and I have MSEE and PhD degrees, also from MIT, in electrical engineering and computer science. I became interested in autism a long time ago when my best friend at the time had a son who was diagnosed with autism following a DPT shot. He had ran a high fever after the shot, seizures a week later, and then was later diagnosed with autism.
We have to accept the fact that autism is new, that before 1930, the rate of autism in the world was effectively zero. And then for a long time, it was one in 10,000.
I got interested in studying autism 8 years ago when I saw the numbers go up, and I was quite alarmed because I could see that the trend was exponential growth. And exponential growth is extremely scary.
Since really the mid to late 80s, we've gone from this low prevalence environment to a rate of increase where the trend is still vertical. We have not seen a flattening in trend.
It's every couple of years, the CDC provides a number of what percentage of the kids are diagnosed with autism. And you've got the dots going all the way back to 1975. You draw the line, it is a perfect exponential curve. If we assume that things are going to continue as they have for the past 30 years into the future, we can predict that by 2032, 80% of the boys born will end up on the autism spectrum. Half the children, 80% of the boys.
In the fall of last year, I got a call from an inside source who told me that in 2 weeks, there's going to be a whistleblower from the CDC who is going to come out and say that the CDC had committed fraud on the MMR study and that they knew that vaccines were actually causing autism. I mean, that's a huge story. Unfortunately, it was a story I would not be able to tell on a medical talk show because a lot of our funding was coming from the pharmaceutical industry. And we were also very good friends with the CDC, who had appeared on our show many, many times. But I knew that once this story broke, 2 weeks later, that the mainstream news media would pick it up, Fox would be on it, CNN would be on it, MSNBC, and we're talking about the biggest medical story in the last decade or two, at least. So that 2 weeks came, and I watched the blogosphere go crazy. Tweets, Facebook, social media, everybody talking about it. But not one mainstream media source went anywhere near the story. In fact, on CNN, someone put the story up on iReport, and CNN took it down. And at that moment, I realized, wait a minute. Not only is my medical talk show being produced by the pharmaceutical industry, all of television is. We were never going to get this story.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. That interview with Robert Kennedy Jr. was just off the hook. It was amazing. You've seen now the foundations for the film that we're going to be previewing in episode 6, Vaccine Syndrome. You saw the filmmakers. Scott Miller is an Academy Award nominated filmmaker. If you know anyone who is in the military, or anyone who knows someone who's in the military, or first responders, they're going to want to see this film. Bring them to Vaccines Revealed, have them register, and make sure they see that film. They need to know the truth about this. It is staggering. And of course, today we aired with our strategic alliance partners the 20-minute version of Vaxxed, and that film is an iconic piece of work in this vaccine movement. Now, in tomorrow's episode, we start out with part one of my interview with Brian Hooker. Brian Hooker, if you just watched the Vaxxed movie, is the center of this movie. Why? Because he is a PhD biochemist who has a vaccine-injured son who is now 18 years of age and autistic. And it led him on a journey that is absolutely astounding. This is a brilliant man, very knowledgeable on these issues, whose life was spent cleaning up the environment, which is where his expertise was, while now he found out that our internal environments are being polluted by vaccines in unspeakable and unconscionable ways. Catch that interview. Tomorrow is part one. It is really staggering. Next, Dr. Tony Bark interviews Dawn Loughborough. Dawn Loughborough is the mother of an autistic child and also a major figure in the vaccine movement. Now, if you heard my interview with Robert Kennedy Jr., he mentioned a mom that came up to him or approached him after one of his presentations on mercury toxicity in the environment. She prevailed upon him that there is a serious issue with mercury and vaccines, which got him started on his entire quest in removing mercury from all medical products. That mother is neuropsychologist Dr. Sarah Bridges, and Dr. Tony Bark interviews her. And wait till you see what this incredible and intelligent woman has to say about vaccines. So again, please share this project, Vaccines Revealed, with everybody that you know. Have them go to vaccinesrevealed.com. Have them register for the free program, and they can get this information just like you. I look forward to being with you tomorrow.